The Bible begins with God. Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God. And if you start anywhere else, you will be facing the wrong direction. The name God appears 32 times in 31 verses of Genesis chapter 1. The main character of the story is God. This is His story, from Him, through Him, and to Him. As Derek Kidner writes, the passage, indeed, the book is about Him, first of all. To read it with any other primary interest, which is all too possible, is to misread it. So even as we begin the story, it is possible to misread the story and make it about something other than what it is. So why might we read this story? Why might we be excited about looking at Genesis 1 through 11? Let me suggest a couple reasons. One is we can read the story out of duty to fulfill an obligation. We may have been taught that the Bible is a book that is to be read. And the Bible is a list of duties, rules, obligations, and our task as people, humans, is to find out what those rules are and obey them. Or secondly, we might read the story, listen to the story for insight, to learn something new, to resolve an intellectual problem or question, to receive guidance, because we believe the Bible is a life guide. Or we might read it for ammunition, to prove others wrong, to combat alternative theories. The Bible is a trump card, a final word on debatable matters. Now, these are not all wrong reasons to read the Bible, to listen to the story. Obedience, wisdom, apologetics, that is, defending the faith, can all be good things. But they can also be a form of funneling. You remember that word? If you've been here for a few years, you're familiar with what funneling is. Funneling is when we hear someone tell a story, we miss the point of the story, and we can turn the story and make it about us. Let me illustrate. Bob?
When I broke my leg, I went to the hospital.
I haven't even asked you to do anything yet. No. You're amazing. Here, hold the mic. Yeah, tell me something about your week. Did you work?
I went to work this week. I had a great time.
Where do you work?
I work at Dish.
What do they do there at Dish? They serve food, or they serve satellite?
They serve dishes. They make boxes for people to watch cable TV.
The electric?
Yeah.
Boxes?
Boxes.
I have a box.
It goes under your TV.
But I don't go with Dish.
Doesn't matter. You still get a box. You go with Chada, you have a box.
Is it the same
Chada?
Box?
You got Chada?
Chada. I wonder where he's from. Are you from Pickens?
Yeah. I'm from Gurr, South Carolina. You know what Gurr is?
Yeah. So you mentioned Charter. You know, our family has had some really bad experiences with Charter. I don't know if that is something, like, to the point where we have, even if Charter were the only provider, we would never use Charter. Now, I could go on about Charter, but it would turn this worship service into something it is not. But do you see what I just did? I mean, it's not sinful to talk about, necessarily, to talk about my experience with Charter, but Bob was telling me about his week, about where he works, and suddenly it became about me and my experience with Charter, and how my wife almost lost her mind due to Charter, promising one thing, doing another. Thank you, Bob. That is a form of funneling. It's like his story, this is where I worked, this is what I do, suddenly became about me. And some of that may have seemed legitimate, like I was trying to connect, like relate. You know, we both have experiences with boxes. And in my mind, suddenly, hey, I have a box story. So if that response, which is not something I have to even try to do, like I instinctively funnel, it drives me crazy because sometimes after I've done it, the Spirit goes, you know, you just funnel. Again, even though you've been talking about this for years, you still do it. It is so instinctive for me to hear a story and to make it about me. Now, obviously, there are times where we need to apply a story to our own experience. There are times where we need to make connections. All of that is legitimate. But as we begin to hear the story, we need to establish right at the beginning, who is this story about? In the beginning, God. So if my primary interest, as Kidner says, is to approach this story for any other reason other than God, I'm going to misread the story. And I'm going to miss the point of the story. I may find a tidbit of wisdom. I may uncover an argument that defeats your position. I may even get a little piece of encouragement, which may be wonderful. But I will, in the end, miss the point of the story. And misread it. And that is why, as we begin... As we begin this series, we need to begin very slowly. This will be the only message that will only cover one verse. This study is going to pick up speed, and at times we're going to be covering whole chapters in one message because this is narrative. We want to be able to hear the story and move briskly through the story lest we miss the flow and the point of the story. But as we begin, we need to begin facing the right direction. All of us are born narrative narcissists. Who was Narcissus? He's the guy we get the name Narcissists from. Narcissus was a guy in Greek mythology who is being pursued by a nymph named Echo. She loved him. He could not, would not respond to her love because he was enamored with his own image reflected in the water. He was fixated with his own face and eventually died. Some versions of the story say he turned into a flower. But he was consumed with himself. We are narrative narcissists. We will naturally read the story, become fixated with our own image as reflected in the story, even a story that is not primarily about us. So in the beginning, God is an invitation right as we start to look away from ourselves to the one who is the beginning and the end. And so let's consider three implications about who God is from this verse. There are many more. Number one, he has always been. In the beginning, God communicates that he is eternal. In the beginning, I am that I am, always was. The full story does not start at creation, but in eternity past, God, who has no cause, caused. He just is, and everything else is dependent on him. Everything else is contingent. Everything else changes. Right from the start, you see a clear distinction between creator and created, as Psalm 102:25 says, of old you laid the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the work of your hands. They will perish, but you will remain. They will wear out like a garment. You will change them like a robe, and they will pass away, but you are the same, and your years have no end. Also, in the beginning, God is not just a reference to time, but a statement about reality. As Kidner writes, in God's presence, the beginning is pregnant with the end. I'll let you think about that for a second. The in the beginning is pregnant with the end, and the whole process present to God, who is the first and the last. The Hebrew word beginning and the way it's used in this verse communicates more than just a start in a moment of time. It implies a period of time that leads to a culmination, an end. So even in this first statement of the story, the stage is set for all the four major themes of the story to unfold. Creation, fall, redemption, recreation, or restoration, all unfold beginning in this initial statement. And we won't look at it in detail, but if you were to jet to the end of the story, at least as the Bible records it in Revelation 21 and 22, it's very interesting, all the creation language at the end of Revelation. You have statements like Revelation 21:1, then I saw a new heaven and a new earth. You have statements referring to Jesus Christ as the first and the last, the beginning and the end. In the beginning is pregnant with the end, because God is eternal. And so his story is not just punctiliar, like a story of the moment. It is an eternal story. And the story is a story that reflects his Trinitarian oneness. Because as Jesus prayed in John 17:5, and now, Father, glorify me in your presence with the glory that I had with you before the world existed. So when creation occurred, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, is the overflow of the eternal Creator who dwells in tripersonal love. As Jesus said in John 17:24, you loved me before the foundation of the world. And if we were to follow that prayer through, he's actually praying that they, us, may know you, the only true God, and Jesus Christ, whom you have sent. So real love has always existed between the Father and the Son and the Spirit, and begins to be manifested to his creation. We're getting way ahead of ourselves here. In the beginning. And that is why the contrast between creator and creature creation is so striking. As the song says, we are a moment, you are forever. Lord of the ages, God before time. We are a vapor, you are eternal. Love everlasting, reigning on high. We're going to see later that there is a direct link between God's eternal creative power and His steadfast love. And it all flows from His eternal Trinitarian oneness. And that's why we run to Him. Deuteronomy 33:27, Moses prayed over Israel, the eternal God is your dwelling place. And underneath are the everlasting arms. Like if we're looking for stability, security, love, anywhere else, it's going to be transient. We will be homeless. The eternal God is your dwelling place. God is eternal. He has always been. Second implication in this opening verse is he is like no other. He is like no other. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. God is unique. There is no one else who, according to Romans 4:17, gives life to the dead and calls into existence the things that do not exist. He is the only creator. Everything else is creation. And this is a huge contrast to the Babylonian creation myths. For example, the story of Enuma Elish, where Marduk defeats the sea monster Tiamat, and from her dead body he forms the heavens and the earth. You see, the Babylonian myths of creation are saturated with this divine sexual activity and violence as territorial deities practice what seems like soap opera-like drama full of sexual escapades and heavenly warfare. And so when you come to Genesis 1, you see none of that. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. There are no competing deities. There are no divine carcasses used to manufacture planets and people. Just the word of the one true God. So we'll see that next week. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one. He is like no other. Thirdly, we see He is over everything. He is over everything. Again, in the beginning, God is a dramatic contrast to all the religions of the day. All the cultures surrounding Israel were polytheist. The Assyrians, the Babylonians, the Phoenicians all worshipped territorial deities. There were gods of the sun and the moon and water and sex and war and harvest. And each of these gods maintained a certain territorial jurisdiction. Like you were the god of this area and you controlled this area. And all the worshipers were trying to figure out which god controlled what area of my life so that I can perform the liturgy and sacrifices to appease that god to make that area of my life livable. That was an endless game of appeasing an endless amount of deities. So in light of this, Genesis 1:1 is one of the most controversial countercultural statements in all of history. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. There was no battle. There was no sexual rendezvous. There was no jealousy or rival. God stands alone as the sovereign creator of the heavens and the earth. And therefore, there is no other creator. There is no court of appeals. For as Psalm 95:3 says, for the Lord is a great God and the great king above all gods. In his hand are the depths of the earth. The heights of the mountains are his also. The sea is his, for he made it, and his hands formed the dry land. God's sovereignty is displayed in his creative power, and his creative word met no resistance or had no assistance. He never went to Home Depot and asked some guy in orange for help. He never submitted his plans to the code office for approval. He never had an inspection. His construction was never halted while waiting for an inspector to come. Never once. Beyond his only code was his own skillful craftsmanship flowing from the eternal blueprints of his creative brilliance. That's what you see in Genesis 1. So here's my big burden as we begin this series. We're going to talk about a lot of what I consider to be really interesting, relevant subjects as we walk through this story. Next week, we're going to get into various theories of creation. Like, how in the world do you make sense of Genesis 1? And then how do you make sense of that in relation to the fact that we live in a highly scientific culture that raises questions about every word in Genesis 1 and 2? We're going to move from there to talk about what it means that a man and a woman, we are, as men and women, we are made in his image. We're going to talk about Sabbath, rest, temptation, work, sin, redemption. I mean, all sorts of significant, foundational, highly relevant subjects. But again, if we explore these without approaching all of these subjects and even the story itself and the text as it records the story from our own perspective, through our, as Alan said at the beginning, through our own hurt, through our own warped view of who God is, we will misread it all. And we'll come away more confused than when we started. The Bible is radically God-centered. In the beginning, God. And that's where we start. That's where we must start. And if our understanding of God is warped, then our view of everything will be skewed. When we talk about in the beginning God, we're not just talking about a sermon series, we're talking about the way you view and do life. And the Bible, as I said earlier, describes an inseparable link between God's creative power as sovereign creator of all things and his sustaining, saving love. And they can't be separated. To get a glimpse of that, let's turn over to Psalm 33. Psalm 33. And think about this in light of the, whatever is heavy on your heart right now. Like, I'm sure every one of you walk through those doors with concerns, burdens, fears, anxieties, addictions, whatever, even just an overall sense of being overwhelmed or confused. And deep in your heart, you feel like, oh, I wish we were talking about this today. That's what I need, is a specific word that would help me navigate this. And I want to say, the way the Bible approaches creation is so foundational. It's not just about answering your questions about the past. It really lays a foundation for everything in your life today and the way you view it and respond to it. You get a glimpse of this in Psalm 33. He begins in the first few verses inviting us to worship. Shout for joy in the Lord, O you righteous. Praise befits the upright. Give thanks to the Lord with the lyre. Make melody to him with the harp of 10 strings. Sing to him a new song. Play skillfully on the strings with loud shouts. Why? Why should we do that? That's just, I'm not musical. For the word of the Lord is upright, and all his work is done in faithfulness. He loves righteousness and justice. The earth is full of the steadfast love of the Lord. Think about that. Every natural law, every sunrise, every bud popping out in spring is a manifestation of the steadfast love of the Creator. By the word of the Lord, the heavens were made, and by the breath of his mouth, all their host. He gathers the waters of the sea as a heap. He puts the deeps in storehouses. Let all the earth fear the Lord. Let all the inhabitants of the world stand in awe of him. For he spoke, and it came to be. He commanded, and it stood firm. Do you see what the psalmist is doing? He is laying a foundation for praise in the eternal, unique, sovereign Creator. And then he's going to begin to apply it. The Lord brings the counsel of the nations to nothing. He frustrates the plans of the peoples. The counsel of the Lord stands forever. The plans of his heart to all generations. So why would you want to put your confidence primarily in a political process or a national ruler? Blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord, the people whom he has chosen as his heritage. The Lord looks down from heaven. He sees all the children of men. From where he sits enthroned, he looks out on all the inhabitants of the earth. He who fashions the hearts of them all and observes all their deeds. There's nothing beyond the scope of his sovereignty. The king is not saved by his great army. A warrior is not delivered by his great strength. As a matter of fact, the war horse is a false hope for salvation. Like tanks and armies aren't strong enough. And by its great might, it cannot rescue. So now he's going to turn. He's going to say, look. He's going to apply. And years ago when we went through this psalm in a series, remember Ross had this last message. We had spent weeks in Psalm 33. And he showed us the contrast between verses 18 and 19, which basically just now turn our gaze on God. Look what he does. And then in response, look what we do. And see the connection. Behold, the eye of the Lord is on those who fear him, on those who hope in his steadfast love, that he may deliver their soul from death and keep them alive in famine. What does God do? God looks upon us. His eye is on those who fear him, on those who hope in his steadfast love. Secondly, he protects us. He looks upon us. He protects us. He delivers their soul from death. Thirdly, he sustains us. He sustains us. So how should we respond? In light of this eternal, unique, sovereign creator who spoke and it was and it stood firm, who's looking on us, who is protecting us, sustaining us. How do we respond? Verse 20, our soul waits for the Lord. He is our help and our shield. For our heart is glad in him because we trust in his holy name. So in response to his looking upon us, we look to him. We look to God. And we, verse 21, we rejoice in God. Like he is the source of our joy. Our heart is glad in him. And then we trust in him. We trust in God. In his holy name. And then the psalmist ends with a prayer. Let your steadfast love, O Lord, be upon us, even as we hope in you. We do not hope in war horses, in political parties, in money, in family, in health, even in churches or preachers. We hope in the Lord. And here's the temptation that the enemy, I think, is sowing among us in times where we're battling whether our hope will be in him or ourselves or something else. The lie is sown by the enemy of our souls that if you hope in God, if you begin with God, if you don't become your own lawyer and if you don't become your own provider and your own advocate and you don't look out for yourself right now, you're going to be abandoned. You're going to be miserable. He's not going to come through for you. And the enemy can provide you with a number of examples where you feel like that has been true in your life. So that you will continue, I will continue to put my hope in me. Or in someone else besides the one who made me. And that is why this... The statement, in the beginning, God, is such a significant call to worship. Because it's really raising huge questions about where we all begin. Where everything begins and where we specifically begin. So I want to bring it right down to this moment. Now, think of what is heavy on your heart right now. It may be a big question. It may be an overwhelming circumstance. You're thinking, I don't know how I'm going to get through this. Or I don't know how I'm going to resolve this. Or I don't know how I'm going to pay for this. Or I don't know what I'm going to do here. Do you have something? Now ask yourself the question that Alan began with. What if God is really who he says he is? What if he is really looking upon us, ready to provide, ready to save? What does it look like for me in this moment to listen to his story, like beginning with his story, not just chronologically, but as far as priority, Lord, this is the story you are writing. This is who you are. And I'm in this. And right now, I can't see how what I'm facing connects with who you are and what you're doing. but by faith, I'm hearing what you're saying, that your creative power, eternal, unique sovereignty is connected to, you're telling me that you're not just out there and up there, you're like looking on me and providing and rescuing and moving toward me in the steadfast love of Jesus. It's what we call the incarnation, is that Emmanuel, God with us. And so right now, where I am right now, I'm saying, Lord, that you are what I want. Like, you are what I need. That's the posture of my heart. I cannot figure this thing out. I can't figure out like where I'm going to be in a week or where I'm going to be in a year or how I'm going to fix this mess I've created or the mess someone else has created. I can't put all the pieces together. But whatever's going to happen, I know I'm starting with you. And I'm asking that your spirit, through the sacrificial love of Jesus, the manifestation of your steadfast love, will both transform my heart and make a way forward. That's that's my prayer. And as we prepare in the beginning of this series to pause and remember that the steadfast love of God is not just something that he said up there, but he did down here in the sacrifice of Jesus. And as we remember his sacrifice, let's take a few minutes to just talk through where we're going to begin. Just like, remember John when he began his book, John 1:1. What did he say? In the beginning was the Word. And the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him. And without him was not anything made that was made. In him was life. And the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it.